I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is Stuart Sutcliffe, The Lost Beatle, originally broadcast on BBC Four in 2005, and at time of recording at least, available to watch for free on YouTube. This hour-long documentary profiles famed fifth Beatle Stuart Sutcliffe, with a strong emphasis on his time playing with the band during their Hamburg years, his relationship with Astrid Kircher, his success and future potential as a talented artist, and his untimely death from a brain hemorrhage at the age of 21. Personally, before watching this, I feel like everything I knew about Stuart Sutcliffe had been informed entirely by the film Backbeat, which we covered in an early episode. But at the start of this film, we have a talking head, Professor Donald Cuspit, who is an art critic and historian, who says that the Beatles' connection with Stuart Sutcliffe is entirely incidental, which is a really nice way of suggesting that actually that is the least interesting thing about Stuart, and actually that his talent as an artist is the real focus that we should have here. I do feel like that then leads into an hour-long documentary about Stuart playing with the Beatles. I don't know how you felt.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, I mean, you know, I agree with him. I'm really into Stuart Sutcliffe for the art. You know, I don't really care about the Beatles stuff. You know, I didn't even know he was in the Beatles, to be honest. Until
the only reason
this.
I'm on his podcast is I thought it was a Stuart Sutcliffe podcast.
I think that one of the things this documentary does get across quite well is that Stuart was remarkable. So no one makes a documentary about Pete Best and says, like, actually this guy had, you know, a lot of talent and all the rest of it. You know, like, Pete Best, he made a contribution to the Beatles story and that shouldn't be ignored, but, you know, in the nicest possible way, no one is sort of saying, like, Pete Best was like a great lost genius, you know. Stuart Sutcliffe, partly because his story is so perfect, because of course he died, but partly because, you know, there's a mythos about him because of this. It does seem like one of the most remarkable things, of many remarkable things about the Beatles, is the sheer coincidence of it all, that the four of them happened to grow up within about 5 miles of each other and happened to meet at exactly the right time. It's ridiculous that those people should have ever met. It's a ridiculous coincidence. The amazing thing about Stuart Sutcliffe is that he was just as remarkable, it seems. Mm-hmm. You know, he had different, his talents were more artistic than they were musical. But this was someone who would have made, certainly this film is suggesting, who would have made a really significant artistic contribution, not to the Beatles necessarily, but to the world, if he had lived. And so I think the film gets that across quite well.
And when you talk about him having a perfect story, in part because he died so young,
yeah.
What do you mean by that in the sense that it's a sort of neatly encapsulated life?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I mean, I don't want it to sound callous, you know. But,
I guess that's what I'm trying to unpick a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's one of those many things about the Beatles story that just kind of seems to be written in the stars in a way, in that sort of almost forgotten right at the start of this story. It is a story of two friends. You know, it sort of it feeds into the mythos of John Lennon to some degree as well, because of, you know, he sort of experienced a lot of death and a lot of trauma early on in his life, you know, and this being like Stuart was his best friend by all accounts, you know, and so much of the Beatles story revolves quite rightly around the relationship between John and Paul. And actually the relationship between John and Stuart seemed at that point in his life seemed to be just as, if not more, important, you know.
And you know, we mentioned in our episode where we discussed Backbeat that that film makes a very pointed reference to how Paul then takes on the mantle of John's best friend,
yeah,
and in a very sort of deliberate referenced way,
yeah,
replacing Stu like as his sort of best friend. I didn't mean to sound facetious by suggesting that the only thing I know about Stu Sutcliffe comes from Backbeat, but I think, you know, what you just said there goes to show that actually it's quite surprising that there isn't more made of that early part of the Beatles story, and there isn't more investigation into Stu Sutcliffe's contribution to the band, but also, you know, his potential as an artist. It doesn't feel like that's a story that's often told.
Yeah, right. And because this is sort of what I'm trying to get across, is that if the Beatles had just gone on to be Herman's Hermits and had just had like three big singles and then you'd never heard of them again, like, yeah, their own story would have been sort of worthy of a documentary film, but also Stuart's story would still have been worthy of a documentary film.
Yes,
because it's fascinating. So it's ridiculous that a story this fascinating happens before they even get going and before anyone's even heard of them.
Mm.
And then they do everything that they do.
Yeah, you're right. It's kind of, it feels like it's on par with like an Ian Curtis type story,
yeah,
only with the band then going on to an even greater popularity and success,
yeah,
after the fact, you know.
Right, yeah.
Do you think this film does justice to that story and does justice to showing Stu Sutcliffe in the right light?
I think it makes some quite specific choices. So, I mean, by the way, I don't know which is the right light in which to show Stuart Sutcliffe, but of course that's kind of documentaries can contribute to that. As we talked about in the Backbeat episodes, the way we think about Stuart Sutcliffe was more influenced by Backbeat than anything else, certainly when we were younger, when we were teenagers, I think. And this film really fills in quite a lot of gaps, I think. Certainly one of the things I really noticed was that there's so many pictures of him in this that I either hadn't seen before or had only seen very rarely. Because there's two or three very well-known ones, you know, the ones that Astrid took. And then the loads of others that I just wasn't at all familiar with. Because I was sort of under the impression that there was very, very little footage of him. There's certainly no video and no audio of him.
And Klaus Voormann says that, doesn't he, in the film. He says that the thing that he's most sad about is that there is no footage of this man.
Yeah.
And that sort of has gone undocumented.
Yeah, and I think that the whole thing adds up to the mythos in a way, in that he just gives the impression that these pictures, and especially Astrid's style of photography, has resulted in these images where he seems quite a sort of spectral presence and quite ethereal, otherworldly. There's one in particular where it's a picture of the two of them and he is sort of kissing her cheek with his eyes closed, and he looks and it's like a sort of Victorian death mask picture or something like that, or sort of reminds you of it, you know, and you're sort of left with this impression that he was a sort of beautiful shadow, you know.
I was struck by the fact that he was a very handsome man.
Yeah.
And I guess I you know, I have seen some of those more popular pictures of him, but there were some images here of him where he seems like an absolute model.
Yeah.
And in a way that is different to the rest of the band, because I think that when we think about the Beatles and how they looked in their Hamburg years, they're still growing into their looks.
Yeah.
A lot of time, apart from Paul, who just always looked like a cute boy.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Whereas he is a fully formed, like, piercing glaze model.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And he talks in this film, in his letters, you know, there's an actor who voices over his letters as if he were Stu reading them. He talks about how, you know, he's suddenly finding himself attractive to women and how that is a surprise to him because he was always the weedy kid at school.
Yeah.
Recently, I've become very popular with both girls and homosexuals who tell me I'm the sweetest, most beautiful boy. Imagine it. Me, the one who had such a complex because I was small and thought I was ugly. It appears that people refer to me as the James Dean of Hamburg. I'm quite flattered.
And then you look at these pictures, it's like, I just don't believe that. You look like you were destined to be a movie star or, yeah, you know, like a model. Again, like I say, and I think that does, he's also got that level of attractiveness that is right, does feel a little bit ethereal. It's almost slightly otherworldly.
Yeah.
It's very striking.
Yeah. But going back to the question you asked me approximately 3 weeks ago.
finally.
About whether the film is sort of getting across the artistic nature and the value of his art as against just the significance of his having been a Beatle. One of the things about art is it is quite difficult to depict in film. I mean, documentary in particular is that because really all you can do is like show the paintings and have an art expert say these are really good paintings, you know, which is, yeah, mainly what they do. It's quite difficult to sort of express art, you know. So if you think about how Backbeat did it, so there's a few scenes where he's kind of painting in like quite a frenzied way, which according to this documentary is actually quite true to life. He did paint like sort of late into the night and then would kind of fall asleep exhausted in a chair, that kind, yeah, of thing, you know. And so they kind of associate that with a sort of restlessness in him. And they turn it into a sex scene as well, I think, don't they?
They do,
like,
yes.
He and Astrid, right, are sort of painting each other. If you remember, like, in The Talented Mr. Ripley, the character of Dickie Greenleaf is a jazz musician. And that's like the thing. Tom Ripley kind of pretends to be interested in jazz in order to sort of get to know him. In the book, Dickie Greenleaf was a painter. He was really interested in painting.
Right.
But I think the decision made was like, that's really hard to depict on film. Just like he's standing there, he's done a painting, and it's like, hey, good painting.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you can't do, jazz is obviously, music in general is obviously a lot easier to do, you know. And so it in a bit of a roundabout way, what I'm saying, finally.
Four weeks and counting.
It is quite hard to get that across. Now, obviously, like, naturally, most of the people watching this documentary are watching it because he was a Beatle.
Yes.
Right. So it knows which side its bread is buttered. It knows that people want Beatles stuff. But yes, I do think it probably goes a little bit too far.
I think there's a few points to unpack there. I think one is that I do find that in this film, there are quite lengthy chunks of time devoted to stuff that the Beatles did generally,
yeah,
without specifying exactly Stu's involvement in that or focusing purely on him. And that's where I feel like it's starting to lose its way a little bit.
Yeah.
I also think that where we do have discussion of Stu as an artist, it does talk about the style of art in which he paints and the method he adopts in approaching his paintings. I think what I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of is an interpretation of his art.
Yeah.
It feels like there's a surface level approach to his output as a painter.
Yeah.
This is basically, here are some of his paintings and here's how he categorized them, as, yeah, opposed to why they work, why they are deemed significant,
yeah,
why they are effective as a painting. So I think there's a bit of a missed opportunity to do a bit of a deeper dive in why we should believe that he would have had a very successful career as a painter.
Yeah.
But also equally, I completely agree with your point. I actually happen to really like his art. I wouldn't know about it if it wasn't for the fact that he was in the Beatles.
No,
like, and I think that that's we have to make allowances for the fact that this film is always going to be capitalising on his connections to the Beatles, even though it's stated up front that that shouldn't be done.
Yeah, it's a funny approach to take, isn't it? There is a bit like sort of, I think it's maybe towards the end where they talk a bit about how these are the paintings he was doing towards the end of his life. And then, but there's a lot of surface level detail applied to that, where like suddenly you're seeing one that is mainly sort of charcoal black and grey, and they kind of say like, he was like, this was the sort of mood he was in towards the end of his life, when he was, you know, he was having like very bad headaches the whole time because of the brain hemorrhage, and you think, like I'm not an art critic, but I think I could have got that like on my own, you know.
Yeah.
The funny thing is that like this was, I don't know about made for, but broadcast on BBC Four. BBC Four, like for anyone who's not in the UK, is a BBC channel that is very very arts and culture based and sort of interesting sort of intellectual documentaries. That's very much what its remit is. And so it is absolutely fair to say it's a sort of liberal intelligentsia audience. And that audience, I think, would actually be pretty forgiving of a decision to talk in more depth about his art and even to have like more than one art critic or historian on there talking about different interpretations and there to be sort of less Beatles stuff in general. So I'm not saying that that is a mistake or a misstep, but actually I think the audience certainly would have tolerated it.
But I think what all of this goes back to is this documentary is Stuart Sutcliffe, The Lost Beatle.
Yeah.
And I think what we end up with in this documentary is a film that doesn't really know quite where to place its focus.
Yeah.
It's in the title, right? Like, if you're going to talk about him as a Lost Beatle, talk about him as his relationship to the band, you know, essentially with the backbeat story. That none of that is explored in great depth. But on the flip side, neither is his work as an artist, and the film doesn't necessarily know how to do one or the other particularly well, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
Talking about how this film aired on a channel that was predominantly arts and culture focused and primarily for, I think you described it as liberal intelligentsia.
Yes.
Let's talk about some talking heads
Sure.
that appear in this film. I think there are some surprising title captions that come up.
Yeah.
There are some people that I haven't heard of before.
Yeah.
Some people have a peripheral connection to the band in their early years. Mm-hmm. Other people who are just former barmaid.
Yeah.
did you have any reason to believe that Rosie McGinnity, I think her name is, has a particularly insightful take on the band at this point?
No, I've never heard of her, but I presume if I went and looked at the index of Tune In by Mark Lewisohn, she's yes. probably in there. So if she was a barmaid at one or more of the clubs where they worked, then she would have been there a lot and seen quite a lot. I'm sure.
You know. I mean, like I say, I don't mean to downplay her role, but having seen a lot of Beatles documentaries in the past, it's quite surprising how this film seems to have an entirely different section of talking heads than I think we've seen in any other documentary.
Yeah,
there's not much overlap with others that we've seen.
Yeah, it's there's a bit of a subset of the Complete Beatles, which also has Alan Williams and Horst Wacher in it.
Yeah,
Astrid Kircher is also in George Harrison Living in the Material World.
Yeah,
I think, which was a bit of a surprise. But as we said, I think Scorsese kind of managed to tempt a lot of people who don't generally do a lot of talking head stuff. So I think it's, as much as anything else, it is just these are the people who were around at this point in their career.
Yes.
So I wonder whether, I'm just thinking, like, Pete Best, you don't really see him do a lot of talking head stuff in general, do you?
He was in the Sgt. Pepper one, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. That's true. Yeah. That's true.
But no, not many others. You're right.
It will depend, because there was a time when Pete Best really didn't want to talk about the Beatles.
Mm.
And then I think from about Anthology time onwards, when he'd sort of got his first proper payday from it, and I think he was sort of, you know, happier just to sort of be involved in things and talk about things. So, like, you know, he did go on American chat shows and things, but generally was not a guy who was popping up in every documentary going.
Yeah.
Which he could have been absolutely forgiven for, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would have been very interesting. Because, I mean, he's a really sort of key eyewitness here, right? In a way that, like, yeah. this documentary is probably not going to convince Paul McCartney to be a talking head, right? Because it's probably a bit too small scale.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's fair.
But Pete would have been really interesting talking head. You never quite know with Pete, because, like, you're often told that because I think because he had a girlfriend, and so, like, when everyone was hanging out, he was off kind of hanging out with his girlfriend quite a lot of the time. But also, you know, Horst Wacker talks about this time when John, like, pissed off the balcony of their flat onto the street below, because Pete also tells that story. You know, he corroborates it, and he was there, like, with John, and he says that John actually, like, pissed on some nuns who were walking to church below. But yeah, I think it may be that Pete is certainly a guy who knew Stuart very well, like, and he would be able to talk in some detail about that, you know.
As evidence as well, by the end of the film, when Astrid talks about their reactions to hearing about his death, like, she says Pete immediately burst into tears.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, you're right. Yeah, we often, relate Pete to him playing in the early days of the Beatles' career, and then his subsequent firing, but not actually his take on the other stuff that was happening around that time.
Yeah.
But the other thing, the important thing, I think, for this documentary is this entirely different subset of Talking Heads just means that there is a little bit of a fresher take presented in this film. We're not really hearing similar kinds of stories or opinions that we hear in many, many other documentaries that sort of retread a lot of the same ground.
Yeah, true.
That said, I think there is probably fair to say that some of what he said in this film is quite controversial.
Yep.
Or is, dare I say, leaning towards sort of more sensationalist material.
Yeah, so there's a couple of fairly well-known theories about Stuart that they go into here. And the documentary is kind of, not quite saying, but sort of on the side of leaning towards these things are true. So the first one is that the cause of Stu's death, his brain hemorrhage, was caused by a beating he had taken. So it is a matter of kind of established record that in 1961, he took a kicking from a load of guys in Liverpool, and John, I think, it rescued him or helped him and broke his finger while doing so. There is also a rumour that at some point, John beat him up, and that's, you know, therefore that caused his brain hemorrhage. I don't know about any kind of, like, established fact about John having beaten him up. Paul and Stuart did have a fight, like, on stage. That's kind of established record. That and Tony Sheridan talks about it in this film, in fact, doesn't he?
Yes. Tony Sheridan implies that the reason for that fight is because Paul quite liked Astrid and was jealous of the fact that Stu was with her.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know how true that is. What Tony does then go on to say, which is where things get a little bit, like, needlessly cheap and nasty. Sheridan goes on to say, I can remember Paul and Stuart having a fight over Astrid. Stuart was with Astrid, but Paul would rather it was him. Paul jumped on Stuart, and not fighting like a guy, but fighting like a chick.
Yeah.
But then he also goes, Paul would forgive me. Well, no, he wouldn't. But with the claws and everything. And he makes, like, this clawing motion.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, what point are you trying to make? There is a, you know, without wanting to go off topic too much, but we can circle back to this. But there is, particularly towards the end of the film, a quite clear and evident anti-Paul bias, I think, that the film has.
Yeah.
Just a few drop mentions of some things. And it just comes across quite distasteful, I think.
Yeah, a little bit. I like the idea of, like, Tony Sheridan say, oh, like, Paul would forgive me, and then immediately say, oh, well, no, he wouldn't, to be honest.
Yeah.
But also the idea that, like, Paul's at home in 2005 watching BBC Four, and just thinking, like, hang on, I don't fight like a chick. Like, I'll show him. And driving around to Tony Sheridan's house and beating him up.
But the implication there, that when Tony says Paul will forgive me, you'd say that if you were talking about a close friend.
Yeah.
and then kind of making like a bit of a sly dig at them, but in like jest.
Yeah.
And you, what you're clarifying to the interviewer is, oh, don't worry, like we're on good terms, it's fine.
Right.
I don't believe that that Paul's forgiveness of Tony Sheridan, whether that exists or doesn't exist, is in any way related to any kind of close friendship that the two of them share at that point in 2005.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I have actually no idea whether Paul and Tony Sheridan have any contact or anything like that. Although you know he does have a history with the band. I'm sure they all like everyone liked him. You know they all got on well. You know,
yeah. But that's what makes comments like that and a couple of other comments that Tony makes in this documentary all the more surprising, because I think he ends up supporting some of the more controversial suggestions that the film makes.
Yeah, to dig a bit further into the point about the cause of Stu's death. So the cause of Stu's death was a brain hemorrhage. So there was a post-mortem done, which gave the cause of death as a blood clot on the brain. And the pathologist said that Stuart had suffered a hemorrhage. I'm sort of paraphrasing, quoting from Tune In by Mark Lewison here. So like Lewison says, Astrid was also told he'd had a rare condition where the size of his brain was gradually increasing and pressing against his skull. So what Lewison says here is, although the association of these two events, talking about Stuart's death and the beating he took in January 1961, although the association of these two events would become an accepted truth, it cannot be more than theoretical. So, you know, maybe sometimes we're sort of in danger of taking absolutely everything in this book as 100% accepted fact. But it is well researched.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And he's taken like a historian's approach to this thing, you know. So what this film does is, so Pauline Sutcliffe, Stuart's sister, who is one of the main talking heads in the film, says that there was the indication that trauma had caused his death. I don't know. I mean, listen, this is Stuart's sister. You know, there's no, it's certainly no reason for her to make anything up. And I don't think for a second she is. And so, and you can quite rightly make the argument that she knows better than Mark Lewison about this stuff.
Yeah, you know, of course.
Of course. But at the same time, like, I haven't read anything that says, as any kind of accepted fact, that his death was caused by head trauma. In fact, it does sound like, you know, he had always been sort of fairly sickly throughout most of his life. You know,
I think the other side of that is, well, is that and this film does this on a few occasions, is that what follows that suggestion is Astrid then immediately shooting it down,
yeah,
and saying John would never have, you know, raised a fist against Stu.
Yeah,
it just wouldn't happen. That's ridiculous. I feel like this documentary is trying to cover both sides of the story in order to be neutral.
Yeah,
but by introducing the idea at all, which feels largely unfounded, it kind of doesn't do that job, you know. So they've introduced this idea of potentially John is responsible for Stu's death because of some violent attack that we don't really know a huge amount about.
Yeah,
and then quickly covered it off with Astrid saying, "No, that would never happen." Yeah. And then the film moves on to something else, you know. But it's quite a big suggestion that the film proposes there at that point.
Yeah.
It does this as well with another big topic, which is when a couple of the talking heads suggest that John and Stu had at one point a sexual relationship.
Yeah.
Again, quite a big suggestion. Yeah. quite, you know, as sort of gossipy controversies go, that's a bit of a whopper. and what happens is the suggestion seems to be based purely on the fact that they were both very close, and that they were both, and particularly Stuart, was sensitive.
Yeah,
and not much more than that by their talking heads' own admission.
What evidence do you need?
Well, exactly. And Tony Sheridan says, like, he says something like, "Oh, who knows how far it went?" And I'm not, you know, they were very close. I'm not interested in what happened after the lights went out, which is,
don't mention it then.
Yeah, exactly. Either, you know, believes it or he doesn't believe it. But surely anyone in their right mind knows that just by saying that, they are making that implication.
Yeah, of course, and quite deliberately as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
but again, like this comes from Pauline in the film, where she says that she had always believed that there had been some kind of sexual relationship between John and Stuart. She never wanted to discuss it when her mother was alive to save her mother's feelings, you know, because it's not something her mother would have liked to hear. But, you know, she always felt like that had been the case. I mean, okay. So she also kind of, there's a backdrop of like pages from her own book, and it's almost kind of presenting it as if like the imagery you're being presented is that, oh, this has been written about, you mm-hmm. know, this is backed up by like writing. She does say something about like other people have written as
yeah.
well. And I think,
yeah.
What other people? I don't know.
Yeah.
He didn't tell me, and John didn't tell me, but other people write about it. And they claim that John told them. If that gets transposed into, oh, Stuart and John had homosexual encounters, if I say they might have done, that's as far as I go.
It's a similar kind of approach to the one about John and Brian that we got in the Brian Epstein story, The Arena documentary, yeah. where there's just, you know, a bit of rumour, and the talking heads just kind of, they just sort of stoke the fire a little bit. They just sort of chum the waters a little bit, you yeah. know, by just saying, well, you know, I mean, I don't know for sure, but, I mean, anything's possible. It's kind yeah, of really yeah. all they're saying.
And Paul was very guilty of that in the Brian Epstein Paul, documentary.
Very guilty of it at the time, yeah. Yeah, I think it's just slightly unedifying, you know, and you know, this is one of the things about the sort of like macho rock star myth. You like John Lennon was there was part of him that was a sort of macho rock star. I think he said in the 1980 the David Sheff interview. You know, there's a lot of me that really likes all the macho rock star posturing. You know, and the idea, and he and Yoko said things about that they kind of considered themselves bisexual, yeah. that kind of thing. There was certainly a kind of sensitivity to him that belied the kind of rock star myth. But no one ever quite wants to go as far as saying, yeah, he definitely like had sexual relationships yeah. with men, you know.
There's sort of lots of tiptoeing around the suggestion because there's this sort of distasteful cheekiness to sort of dancing around the topic
yeah.
and making sort of these insinuations and having a bit of fun by doing that.
Yeah.
Without really committing to an actual
yeah.
claim.
Yeah, and actually, like, one of the things these days about Beatle fandom is that particularly, you know, we're recording this, like, quite soon after the release of Now and Then. There's been lots of, like, really lovely fan commentary on social media, particularly from younger fans, who like people who I assume to be teenagers, who are just really, really into the idea that John and Paul loved each other and are entirely uninterested in whether that was sexual or non-sexual.
Yeah.
We're just into the idea. They just the idea of like two men loving each other is just is not something they find at all complicated or yeah, something yeah. that needs to be agonized over, or like, but how did they love each other? Like, and how far did it go? You know,
but I think I don't want this to contradict the point you're literally just making, but I think my reaction to this being explored in the way that it is in this film is that if this film is supposed to be a profile of Stuart Sutcliffe, raising this idea, which is quite a significant claim to make about a person, and doing so in a very sort of unsatisfying way, where it's being sort of raised as a potential idea that's kind of just teased by a couple of people, and then also, by the way, immediately shot down by Alan Williams, the former Beatles manager, who says
yes.
No, they were just close friends,
yeah.
and then the film moves on,
and Astrid as well,
and Astrid as well, yeah, of course,
yeah.
And I think, you know, regardless of the question about whether or not they did have a sexual relationship, the film itself presents it in such a tawdry way
yeah.
by not giving it any focus. It's almost giving into this need to sort of get some attention
yeah.
to this idea and this topic without really giving it too much investigation,
yeah.
Which just, in my mind, just makes for a very ineffective documentary.
Yeah, yeah. I will say that, like, Alan Williams' dismissal of the idea, because I think he says, no, they were just good mates or something like that. Yeah, yeah. But that does seem like something that a man of his generation would dismiss, because it's just like, the idea of two men having a sexual relationship is just so outside my sphere of experience. Yeah, yeah. I just can't imagine that it would ever happen.
No, I do agree with that. And it does feel a bit like they were just good mates, and I'm basing that on nothing other than the fact that I would know otherwise, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It just didn't seem like it. They just seemed like nice young men, you know? That kind of attitude.
Yeah, sure. If a bit long-haired, you know? But I wonder whether the friendship they had that was based on, you know, they seemed to kind of like bring out the best of in each other. And they do talk like quite nicely at the start of the film about how I think Pauline says, like, when Stuart became friends with John, like, his friends up until that point had all been like quite parent friendly. Okay, mm-hmm. You know, you could bring them home and your parents would like them. And John was the first one who wasn't. Like, you know, he was sort of very rebellious and like liked stirring things up, and was even like quite violent at times, you know. Mm. And sort of not the kind of boy who your mother wanted you to hang out with. And but it does seem that they had a kind of like shared appreciation of art and music that really brought out the best in them. It seems like a really formative friendship. And I wonder whether the sensitivity that probably abounded in that friendship, whether at the time people didn't really have any better way of framing that as anything other than like, this must be a sex thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, it may be a bit of that, you know, because it's easy to forget. Like at this time in early 60s, or was it late 50s they met even? Or maybe, you know, I don't know. But anyway.
They met in 59, I believe.
Right, okay. So sort of around this time, bear in mind that even things like hugging a male friend as a greeting was just basically unheard of. Mm. I remember Derek Taylor wrote about how when he and his wife had gone to visit the Beatles somewhere and John and George came to meet them and hugged them and said, this is the new thing, hugging your friends. This would have been, what, 67 or something. Like,
yeah.
You know, don't shake hands, you know, like hug your friends, show them you love them, you know. And Derek Taylor, being a pretty sort of with it kind of guy, was just a bit kind of like, oh, it's a bit weird, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was 1967, you know, so sort of 7 or 8 years earlier, that kind of sort of like showing male friends affection was just not done, particularly in a place like Liverpool, right? You know,
I think one of the nice things that this film does is does suggest at one point that it was Stuart's sensitivity. And maybe sensitivity ends up becoming the wrong word. Maybe like his openness to be creative is ultimately rubbed off on John. And it was Stuart that sort of brought that side out in John, ultimately, that we then see explored throughout the rest of the Beatles' career.
Yeah.
Which is quite a nice suggestion, and if we put stock in that theory, actually puts even more credence on Stuart's contribution to the band as a whole, beyond that of just one-time bass player.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, there is that chapter in Tune In that I was quoting from earlier, I think is called, name of the chapter is He Could Have Been The Beatle, which was a quote made about Stuart. I think the idea was that, you know, the sort of artistic contribution he could have made. Maybe it was probably in the Backbeat episode when we were talking about it, where, you know, we sort of said that, well, maybe like Stuart might have gone on to be a sort of artistic collaborator and, you know, played a similar role to Klaus Voormann in terms of like designing album covers. But also that idea that the Beatles could have been a sort of art collective, as they kind of, you know, showed signs of becoming involved in, when they were sort of hanging out with art collectives like The Fool around 1967, 66. That's the kind of environment that Stuart might have really thrived in, you know. And actually that the Beatles were not just a musical contribution. They were, they made a cultural and an artistic contribution to the world as well. And he could have been a part of that potentially. Or, you know, it just in my saying that, I might be guilty of doing what this documentary does a bit too much of, and just framing his life entirely around
the Beatles.
Oh yeah, he could have gone on and he could have worked with the Beatles in this way. Or he just would have been a massively successful and brilliant painter and have had dinner with them every now and again but never collaborated with them.
The peaks and successes of his career don't have to be always tied in with the Beatles,
of course,
right?
Yeah,
talent oozed out of him without him doing anything much. And John had to sort of really work hard to make the talent that he had, which was not a little either, but to get it over and say, well, here's my talent too, guys. You know, I think it was a little envious of Stuart in that sense.
Talking of close friendships, we should discuss Rod Murray.
Yeah.
Who's an old college friend, I think it's Stuart. He's one of the key talking heads in this film.
Yeah.
One of the things that this film does with Rod, which it always immediately takes me out of any film, is for some reason his contributions to the Stu Sutcliffe story are mostly told whilst he's driving around Liverpool.
Yeah.
And the camera is positioned, like presumably set up, fixed on him as he's driving around.
Yeah.
He's not being driven, like he is watching where he's going, you see him signalling, you know.
Yeah.
And I always feel like, why have they made a decision to do that particularly with Rod? I mean, obviously the answer is, he is telling a story about where they used to go when they used to hang out. Yeah. And I think on one occasion in the film, but only one, he actually stops outside somewhere and mentions, oh, this is a place where we used to go.
Yeah.
But on the whole, the rest of it is just very different to the other Talking Heads, where those interviews are just conducted in a room in their house.
Yeah.
You know, and I always feel like, did Rod watch this back and be like, oh, hang on a minute, it didn't make Pauline drive around Liverpool, why did they make me do that, you know?
Yeah, it's funny that how the idea of sort of being in the place where a thing happened, they parody that in the Ruttles, don't
they?
Yes,
right? They do. It's great. Yeah.
Where like he's in the car saying, you know, oh, I'm in New York where this happened. Well, not here in the car. Or,
yes,
you know,
that's
not
right,
in the car in the city anyway. And in the Brian Epstein story, they're sort of standing in the street outside his old house. I forget who the talking heads are who are doing that. Maybe it's his former secretary or something like that. I'm afraid. But there is a bit of a point made of just like, here is where this happened, you know. And with, so I think it's Gambia Terrace where they lived, where they had a flat, and the other one was Percy Street. So yeah, like Rod kind of like drives from one to the other and they're more or less on adjacent streets, I think. And you think, okay, I mean, because what you could have done is just like it not showed any footage of him driving, but just shown him like standing in the street outside saying, this is where we lived, points up at a window, that was John's bedroom or whatever.
Yeah.
And then show him walking down the street a bit, then cut to him being in the next street doing the same thing again.
Yeah. Which is kind of what they do with Horst Macker, right?
He's
in Hamburg and he's like pointing at buildings.
That's
and,
right. You know, yeah. Here's the balcony that John urinated off.
You know? Yes. I forgot to pick you up on that earlier when you said about what John did. The words that Horst actually uses is he gets wee-wee everywhere.
Yes.
I think, or pee-pee everywhere or something. It's very childish, strangely childish in his sort of thick German accent. It's very odd.
Right. Especially for a man who was apparently a sort of fairly violent gangster as well.
Yes, exactly. It's really, really odd.
Yeah.
The other thing I like about Rod is he goes to check out Stuart Sutcliffe's guitar.
Yeah.
He goes to sort of a local museum where it's stored. And I think the implication is that he hasn't seen this guitar, I think, what does he say, it's in like 45 years or something.
I think that's what he says, yeah.
But what I found really interesting about that is, you know, he's about to open the guitar case to look at the guitar. And he basically says, you know, this will tell me whether this is actually the guitar that Stuart played.
Yeah.
And he opens the case and he sees the guitar and he says, yeah, looks like it. Oh, is that it? Like, it's one of those moments that we often come across in these films where I feel like the filmmakers are hoping for a bit of a bigger reaction and they're trying to capture it.
Yeah.
But he basically, and then he does the thing where he says, I've actually got a photo of an old college friend of ours playing this exact guitar.
Mm.
And they show the photo on screen and it's from behind the guy playing it. So you can only see the headstock of the guitar. And it's not like this is clearly the same guitar.
Right.
It's a bit of like, I don't know, like the filmmaker's trying to like connect the threads a little bit into one scene and actually not quite pulling it off because Ultimately, they're trying to make a big deal about the fact that, you know, we are now going to visit Stu Sutcliffe's actual original guitar, and actually don't quite give it the real events moment in the film that I think they're trying to get to.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things I really like about Rod Murray. He's a guy like, I couldn't tell you which ones, but I've seen him in other documentaries. But he is not generally popping up in every documentary going. He's not trying to make a name for himself or make any money out of the whole thing. I don't know, maybe he did a book at some point. I've no idea, but not that I can think of. And I think he's sort of generally happy to be interviewed about. So, you know, he lived with John and Stuart and was an art college friend of theirs. And that's kind of it, you know. But he doesn't seem to be always doing the rounds of these things. He seems like a really contented guy who is just happy to discuss this, but, like, it's not the biggest deal in the world. You know?
I wonder if that's because when you have films that tell sort of the larger Beatles story, Stuart Sutcliffe, unfortunately, I think, comes off as a bit of a peripheral character in that story.
Mm.
And then if you then extend that to Rod as well, that's almost one step too removed from the focus of any given film.
Yeah.
But obviously this film, that makes perfect sense too, right? Because it's just focused purely on Stuart.
Yeah, that's right.
Another person that I wanted to mention your way is Alan Williams. We mentioned him earlier.
Yeah.
He's someone that I don't feel like we see too often.
Yeah.
Considering what seems to be a very significant title of former Beatles manager.
Yeah, yeah.
He's very present in this film.
Yeah.
But yeah, on the whole, I would suggest that he's a sort of a largely forgotten person in the Beatles story.
Well, I think probably his significance, certainly with sort of books that have been written over the last 20 years or so, has sort of made his contribution a lot clearer. I think maybe there was a bit of a view of him as a bit of a self-promoter for a while. Yeah. Certainly in the Complete Beatles documentary, in which he was also a talking head, he did seem to be putting himself at the center of things a bit too much. You know, but listen, this guy was their manager and he was responsible for getting them to Hamburg, you know. And there is an argument that if they didn't go to Hamburg, they wouldn't have got as good as they were and they wouldn't have made it. And they would, you know, and like maybe they wouldn't have got a record deal at all and they would have been forgotten about, you know. The importance of Alan Williams is undoubted. But yeah, I think maybe there was a period when there were documentaries being made. Because bear in mind, when we talked about the Complete Beatles, we were talking about how this was, what, 20 years after their first single. It was 1982, I think it was. And that was a point at which there was a bit of a renewed interest post John's murder in people watching documentaries about the Beatles. It was probably thought before then there wasn't much of an audience for it. And so at that point, Alan Williams was a guy who probably had been forgotten about a bit and was like only too willing to quite reasonably and rightly go in documentaries and say, actually, yes, I did this stuff, and I was a significant part of the early days of the Beatles.
I think the other side of it as well is that I tend to find in these documentaries that the people that are interviewed tend to fall into one of two camps, which is sort of trusted Beatles insider and friend of the band and someone who's willing to sort of toe the Apple line, as it were. And then there are loose cannons. and I feel like Alan Williams, like, there's, you know, a couple of things that he says in this. So he mentions quite almost offhandedly, this is the first time that the band had their first bout of gonorrhea.
Yes, of course.
It's one of the things he says. Yeah. He also, quite interestingly, talks about when he was sacked as their manager, and he sort of quite pointedly says that John refused to pay me commission. And to be fair, he ends up turning that into quite a self-deprecating joke where he says, you know, well, you guys will never work again. And actually it was me that never worked again, which is fair to him for that. But yeah, he does seem like the kind of character in these stories where he can't necessarily be trusted to upkeep what the band might want to keep as a squeaky clean image.
Yeah, perhaps. I suppose he would have seen quite a lot of stuff. Actually, so Alan Williams kind of took them there, but then went home. you know. So yeah, like, it went back to Liverpool. So I don't think it sort of stayed there with them, certainly not for any significant amount of time. So
former Beatles manager implies sort of like an ongoing management of their services and, you know, affairs.
So I think, to be fair, it is acknowledged pretty much universally that he was officially their manager.
Right. Okay.
Like they what contract they signed or whatever, I don't know.
Sure.
But he describes himself as such, and the others, like Paul in the anthology, mentions him as, you know, we had a manager at the time who was really good for us at the time.
Yeah, yeah, sure, you know. Okay. Apart from that, he let us all get gonorrhea. Presumably.
that is a detail that, like a lot of other details, is not mentioned in the Beatles anthology.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Just quickly, as a quick aside, there's a moment in this film around the same time where the narrator talks about the band first arriving in Hamburg, and there is a shot of the crowd, and the idea being this is a crowd at a Beatles gig, right? I don't know if it is or not. But the narrator then says that sex was freely available. As he says this, the camera sort of focuses it in on one girl's face in the crowd, who's just there enjoying a gig, you know? It's like, has she, now a grown woman, now watched this back and been like, well, hang on a minute, I was there once, I saw a live band, had a great time, went home.
Yeah.
And you zoomed in on my face while saying that sex was freely available. It was really odd.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And also, I'm now like 70 years old.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, I'm watching this with my grandchildren, saying I used to know those guys. I thought, what an unfair choice to make.
It's very true. Actually, it's like, it's sort of talking of the narration. So the narrator is Paul Morley, who was an NME journalist and sort of wrote for various publications, and also is a guy who has done a lot of sort of music documentary work. You know, like BBC 4 documentaries. In fact, like most Saturday nights, you will see a music documentary in which Paul Morley is a talking head. He's second only to Gambaccini, really, like in those stakes. But he says a few things in it. So listen, I don't know whether he wrote his narration or not, but there are a few things he says that they're big generalizations, and he says them, and then they move on, and it's, you know, and it's kind of, and it's the sort of thing that just a lot like some of the more sensationalist claims that are made in this film. You kind of think that it's dealt with so quickly that it just kind of like goes under the radar, and you can see how these things would just become accepted fact. One thing he says is that right at the start. He says something about like the early success of the Beatles wasn't just down to Liverpool charm or the volatile relationship between John Lennon and Paul McCartney, but .. And you think, oh, hang on, was their relationship volatile in the early days? I don't think so particularly. Was it later on? Maybe, yeah. But like,
he also says right at the very end when they cover Stu's death. I think how he as a narrator wraps up what happens immediately after that. I wrote this down. He says, Stu's death really crushed John, forcing him to turn to Paul for artistic and emotional truth.
Yeah.
until he couldn't even rely on that, and he turned to Yoko.
Yeah, and I
just thought, like, what a weird way to completely gloss over the most successful songwriting partnership in history.
Yeah,
like, he turned to Paul for artistic and emotional truth, and then he couldn't even rely on that. And it's like, they had a very successful career together.
Yeah.
What an odd phrasing.
I would think. So, like, given the time period, so it's 2005, and given that it's Paul Morley, I would imagine, I don't want to misrepresent him because I am, because I'm not, I haven't read or can't remember reading Paul Morley writing about the Beatles, but I would bet he's a Lennon guy and Paul is a lightweight guy. Maybe he's not anymore, I don't know. But certainly that would have been a popular opinion at the time.
Yeah.
And he is very much from a school of NME journalism from like the early 80s.
Yeah.
Who would have been very into that idea, I think.
There was there's a bit early on as well where I think it's the narrator saying this, but he says that when Stu first starts seeing Astrid, and he says that he started living with Astrid and painting, and he kept missing band practice, and then he says, which infuriated Paul.
Yeah.
And it's and maybe that's true, but there were just a number of digs like this at Paul throughout the film, and particularly towards the end of the film. It starts to add up to quite a negative picture, like deliberately negative picture, and that bias becomes really obvious.
Yeah, I think so. So I think it is fair to say that Paul was frustrated at Stu's bass playing ability. These days, I think it's sort of more widely accepted that Stuart was a sort of better bass player than he was often depicted as. But certainly, like, he was not a natural musician, and Paul wanted the Beatles to be good musicians, unreasonably. Yeah. Like, and was into the musicianship and the craft of it, you know. And certainly he was a bit more of a sort of general virtuoso player than John or George, I think it's probably fair to say. And I have read that the fight that he and Stuart had on stage was actually about Stuart's sort of incompetence on the bass, you know, which it seems like quite a petty thing to get into an actual physical fight with about someone because he'd played C sharp by accident, you know. So, yeah, it does kind of add up to that sort of picture of Paul as being a bit of a perfectionist and things. Should also be said that apparently, like, by all accounts, those sort of, certainly the first trip to Hamburg, Paul was sort of the least popular of them. And I think, so, like, there were lots of evidence that in letters and things, I think Stuart kind of wrote home and said, well, Paul seemed, he's sort of, he's the one who everyone's kind of shunning and ignoring a bit, and he's sort of out of the gang a bit, that kind of thing. I think Paul also said about Stuart's death, I mean, much, much later, I mean, but it said, like, you know, it was, the tough thing was that, like, when Stuart died was that I didn't like him very much, you know, but I never got the chance to say, I'm sorry about that, like, you know, we were kids and it wasn't that important, but, you know.
I think that there's a difference in my mind between the actual events that the film is telling and the way that it expresses them. Because I think that when we're talking about there being a bias with Paul, when the narrator says that, you know, Stu missing band practice or whatever it was, which infuriated Paul, what the film isn't then doing that is qualifying that statement with who was a bit of a perfectionist in his approach to the band's music, you know, which is all it takes.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of having that remark deliberately clipped at a point where it's sort of suggesting that Paul was a bit of a hard person to be around is where that bias comes through, because it's deliberately not doing Paul any favors.
Yeah, it does seem that way, doesn't it? He doesn't come off that great. It does seem like the sort of documentary where he doesn't seem to have a lot of right to reply. Well, I mean, you know, I'm sure I'm sure it's not the sort of documentary that he would have appeared on necessarily. But yeah, it does seem a bit like people are like, no one's kind of sniping at him necessarily, but he is getting slightly short shrift.
Yeah. You know? Obviously, one main talking head in this film that we haven't really spoken about much is Astrid herself.
And, yeah.
And I think one of the film's strengths is that it does go out of its way to emphasise the significant contribution that she made to the Beatles and obviously the Beatles' image at the time, which I think is, I don't want to say uncharacteristically nice of the film, but it does seem to sort of explore that in a bit more detail than other areas in the film, which is quite nice to see.
Yeah, I think, you know, she and... It's always nice to see Klaus Voormann as well, because Klaus is a pretty regular talking head on Beatle documentaries, but he really seems to just have his head screwed on. Again, he's not sort of promoting himself, you know, and so it's always nice to see him. But yeah, Astrid is kind of, you don't see her all that much, you know, and she, you know, passed away a couple of years ago now, but yeah, you didn't used to see her all that much in general. And yeah, I think she's very, very calm and level-headed presence in this film. So certainly where claims are being made, she seems uninterested in... So some of them she just kind of dismisses, but also she's not really making any grand claims of her own.
Yeah.
She's talking quite simply and quite sweetly about Stuart. She said one of the really lovely things she said that quite surprised me, actually, was she said, "Oh, I actually still have a picture of him on my bedside table," which was lovely, given that she would be, how long? So 45 years or so since he died, here. But with that, and that's a really nice detail. I really got the impression that she was quite a significant figure to them. We kind of know that the Beatles were able to sort of go to her house and sort of wash there because they didn't really have and sort of get a good meal and stuff, you know. I actually, like, when I went to Hamburg, I did that walk from the Grosse Freiheit up to Astrid's house, and you walk it in. I remember thinking, oh, it's quite a long walk, but it was sort of 25 minutes or something that.
Yeah.
But you do very much get the sense on that walk that you are going from a sort of, this was during the daytime, so Grosse Freiheit is really just, it's perfectly normal and safe to walk down. But obviously, like, in the evening, it's a lot seedier and stuff, you know.
Sure.
But you do get the impression that you're walking from a sort of slightly grimy downtown area into a really nice middle-class area. And you can see that the Beatles would have been quite impressed by this, you know, and thinking like, oh, okay, this is a decent place, you know, and looking at the house, you can get, you know, to the extent you can't go in or anything, but, like, you know, they wouldn't let me for some reason, but you know, you can see, like, this is a nice place, you know. But I think she had a kind of, I think there was a sort of mothering thing going on towards all of them, and you get the impression from other sources and also from this film that everyone fancied her. Tony Sheridan says something like, she was, you know, the kind of person who, like, you know, she could just say one thing and, like, really light up your day or something like that. And my understanding was she didn't actually speak an awful lot of English, and Stuart didn't speak lots of German. And that they actually couldn't communicate very well with each other. But I don't know, maybe everyone learned quickly or whatever, or they were using translators or whatever it was, I don't know. But yeah, you get the impression. So there's a claim made that sort of Paul fancied her, and that was the source of some jealousy with him and Stuart. Stuart obviously fancied her. Like, Backbeat is kind of certainly suggesting that John fancied her.
Yeah.
And let's throw George in as well. He probably did. Yeah. Who knows? You know.
Probably Pete.
Yeah, why not? Yeah. You know.
The other thing as well is, you know, going back to that question about the anti-Paul bias as well, she's the only one who says anything nice about Paul, which is that when she talks through how she breaks the news of Stu's death to the band, she says that Paul just held me in the kind of beautiful way that he does.
Yeah.
Which is quite a sweet description to give. Incidentally, actually, the other thing about that part of the film is that she does tell us in that moment that George Harrison knew about Stu's death before the others, which was quite an interesting detail.
Yeah.
Purely because he travelled over on the plane with Stu's parents.
Yes.
I think, and his relatives. So he would have known about the news from that first. Whereas Astrid told the rest of the band when they arrived at the airport.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe. And then she goes on to talk about John's reaction, which is quite, I guess, in keeping, I think, of what we know of John. It seems quite a sort of a manic and unpredictable, you know, grief stricken moment for him.
Yeah, I've heard sort of a few different accounts of this. So, like, I think she says the most popular one seems to be that he kind of like laughed hysterically in it was sort of laughter that turned into tears, or where like, you know, the laughter and the tears were essentially the same thing. I think Paul actually disputes that slightly and says no, that wasn't quite his reaction, but he did flip out or something like that. Pete Best as well, I think, said that he did just sort of flip out in the airport in some way.
Right.
I forget. These are not wildly differing accounts.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
The idea of like, oh, my best friend is dead and my reaction is to laugh. It's a nervous reaction when you can't quite believe something.
Yeah, yeah.
To laugh, you know.
I think they're all reasonable ways to react, you know, with sort of sharp and sudden grief.
Yeah,
But, and also they can all be true.
Yeah,
they're not too wildly differing accounts, are they?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this film goes to great pains to show us and tell us that John and Stu had a very singular friendship, so it kind of is in keeping with that.
Yeah, and I think it's making suggestions at the start that John was very deeply affected by Stuart's death, and I'm sure he was. It would be it'd be odd if he wasn't, in a way. You know, as I said, like, he had been affected by an abnormal amount of death in his young life. There's a scene, there's a sort of montage scene right at the start of the film where they're using footage of John skiing, and it must be from Help, I guess.
Yeah.
And I guess it must be, and I don't think he's dressed up in the sort of Help, the clothing he was wearing in that scene in Help. So I think it must be when they were rehearsing or practicing skiing or something like that. But anyway, and you think, well, that's an odd choice. Why are you showing him skiing? And then, because his face is quite, you can see that he's cold. His face is kind of like quite ruddy, and he looks sort of slightly worn down. He's obviously like slightly tired because he's been skiing. And he's also, they're sort of using little, like a bit of video, but it also just kind of turns into still images. And the still images are generally him looking worn out, haggard, and sort of looking off into the distance, almost as if sort of looking around for someone who he thought would be there. And, you know, and I suppose like what it's trying to do is kind of hint that is Stuart that he's thinking about. Not in any absolute or literal way. And the music it's using, there's a live version of This Boy that it's using. And specifically, the line, "This boy wants you back again," is sung while we're sort of seeing these images of John. So it's certainly making that suggestion that this was, that Stuart's death left a big hole in his life.
Yeah, I mean, there's one of those instances in that moment is him framed very much to the left, with sort of like a big space next to him. He's almost looking at the space. So, you know, it's very much indicating that there is that hole that you're talking about there is very much visually represented in that moment.
Yeah,
you're right. The use of the music is actually quite interesting throughout the documentary, actually, because I think the film starts with "Love Me Do," and then you have that live version of "This Boy," and there are moments in the film where it plays "Love Me Tender," which is a reference to Stu singing that live to Astrid. But then right at the end of the film, it sort of pulls "Jealous Guy" out of nowhere, which is and I was left a little bit baffled as to why that particular song choice was made, because it's not really related to the period. I don't think it sort of, you know, lyrically ties to anything that's happening in the film at the moment that it's played. So yeah, it's a strong sort of, other than the fact that it's sort of tonally right, it's a, you know, it's a relatively melancholic song.
Yeah,
maybe that's all there is to it. But yeah, some sort of stranger choices made there.
Yeah, I think that is probably the extent of it. And you're right that like tonally, it works. It's also sort of over a backdrop of some drawings that I think are by Klaus Voormann, That's a picture of John in sort of anguish, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of drawings by Klaus throughout it, depicting things like when sort of Paul and Pete were locked up in a jail cell after being arrested for arson and all that kind of stuff, which are nice and, like, you know, they illustrate the whole thing well. The version of Love Me Do at the start is a live version, and then this boy is a live version, which suggests to me that it's that they could get the rights to that. Throughout it, there are lots of general rock and roll songs that have been played by what we're told in the credits is a band called the Prellies, which is a reference to the Preludin, which is one of the uppers that they took to keep themselves awake when they were performing in Hamburg, which they used to call Prellies. So the band being called that suggests that it's probably session musicians who were put together in order to do a soundtrack
For this.
And then Jealous Guy. And you're right, it's a strange song. So I presume, like, Jealous Guy is the studio version. It's easier to get the rights to use John Lennon things than it was to use Lennon McCartney things.
Yep.
So that would have played a big part. But, yeah, I mean, maybe in terms of sort of solo John Lennon songs that you want to convey a certain mood, but bear in mind a lot of it is quite on the nose.
Like
Mother
where
there's certainly anguish in his singing, but he's specifically singing about his mother being dead, and so it just doesn't fit enough, you know.
Yeah, but I think that's my point about Jealous Guy. It feels, you know, that, you know, I'm just a jealous guy. Like the narrative of that song, again, I know we always come back to this question, but the narrative of that song doesn't necessarily fit with what I think the film is trying to say at that time.
No,
like, who's right. Jealous of who when that song's playing, right? That's what I don't get.
Yeah, I don't know.
And while talking of giving up, that's probably a good point at which to end the discussion. As always, we would love to hear from you if you have seen the film at all, if you have any thoughts on Stuart Sutcliffe and his role in the band. Please reach out to us and contact us on any of the social media platforms. We are at Beatles Films Pod. Also, if you're interested in any of the other films we've referenced in this episode so far, we have covered a lot of Beatles films in the past. We've recorded episodes talking about Help and Yellow Submarine, Magical Mystery Tour, as well as some of the others we mentioned earlier, the Brian Epstein Arena documentary, most recently The Complete Beatles, George Harrison Material World. We've covered them all. Please feel free to explore our back catalogue of episodes and give those a listen. And if you like any of those episodes, or if you've enjoyed listening to this episode, we would really appreciate it if you could give us a 5-star rating or a review. It really helps other people to find us, and we can help grow the Beatles Films Pod community. Otherwise, we'll see you again next week for another episode. And until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.